Before we get started with this episode, I want to share something that I think could be a game changer for your classroom. Now, as a former special education teacher, one of the things I struggled with the most was creating activities, resources, and curriculum for my classroom. I did not realize that that was part of my job. I have spent the last 10 years developing the Autism Helper curriculum based on what was missing from my former classroom. And now we finally have a way for school districts to purchase this curriculum directly for their teachers. The Autism Helper Curriculum Access is an annual subscription that provides access to all levels and subjects of our curriculum. This curriculum is rooted in evidence-based practices, it's aligned to the standards, and we just completed our pilot case study showing the overall effectiveness. To learn more about how your district can get curriculum access, head over to theautismhelper.com and click Curriculum Access. Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism. Welcome back to the Autism Helper. I'm excited to share my interview with Dr. Erin Mishaw today. She's an SLP and BCBA with over 20 years experience with behavioral interventions. Today, Erin is sharing her work with the Early Markers of Autism Project. This project looks for the earliest behavioral indicators in infants who are at higher risk for being identified with autism. These are mostly infants that have siblings with autism already. Erin is sharing that most pediatricians start assessing for autism at 18 months, whereas Erin in this project is looking for those milestones as early as 1 month old. Such a big gap between 18 months and 1 month, and so many potential opportunities to work on building skills. And that's exactly what Erin is talking about today and the work that she is doing within this project. If you currently have a baby or you have parents that have siblings of students in your classroom that are asking questions about diagnosis and assessment, this is absolutely a must listen. I found this conversation so interesting and so informative. And Erin addresses the common question, should I wait and see what happens or should I go for an assessment now? So let's dive into talking with Dr. Erin Mishaw.
Hi, Erin. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Sasha. It's great to be here.
I am looking forward to this topic because it is something we have not discussed a ton on the podcast, and it's not something I know a ton about. So I'm excited to have you really teach us about early autism diagnosis and early identification signs.
Great.
So to kind of get us started, I know you work with the Early Markers of Autism Project, and I'd love to hear more about that in a little bit. But when you, to kind of even get us started, the first question that I thought of, you know, being a mom, having raised infants and, you know, seeing babies all the time, what are the earliest behavioral indicators that you are looking for infants that have that higher likelihood of autism, have that sibling with autism? What are those behavioral indicators that you're looking for?
Yeah, so right away, right at 1 month, and we do go into the homes, you know, sometimes we're in when the babies are 2 weeks. We look for a few things, starting with that sustained eye contact. You know, right away, babies can do that. And then from the sustained eye contact, we look at tracking. So when a baby's sort of locked in on our eyes, if we move to the right, if we move to the left, do they follow us? We also look for localizing voice. And what this is, you know, when we're close to the baby but out of their sight, do they find us? And you'll see if you look online, you can find videos that in the hospital rooms, you know, babies will be, say, being held by the nurse and their mom starts talking to them a foot or two away and the baby will turn their head, you know, at days old. And
wow,
it's so exciting to see. Yeah. So we look for that right away. So those are some of the things we look for right at 1 month. And then as time goes on, we add different markers to look for. So for example, at 2 months, we start looking for that reciprocal cooing, which I love as a speech pathologist, and the smiling, which is always fun too. By 3 months, we start to look at some of that shifting of attention. So does the baby look from an object? So maybe a red object, because babies love objects, to a person. So do they sort of shift their attention back and forth? And for the most part, right at 3 months, babies are doing this, sometimes even earlier.
It's crazy to think about, like, the in the hospital room or a 2-week-old, you know, we think of babies is like this little lump sometimes, but that they're really engaging in those social interactions right away.
It's great. I mean, I've learned so much from being on this project. And, you know, now that I've been a few years doing it, it's one of the most exciting things is showing parents that their babies can do this and watching how amazed they are. Like, I would never have known that the baby will find my voice like that. And it's great because when we point these things out, then they notice going forward. So it's more exciting, and, you know, the parents react in a natural way and they're excited that their babies are doing these things. So it kind of contributes to the back and forth and giving more opportunities for it to happen, which is great.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, obviously, you know, all kids and babies develop at different rates and that varies. So when thinking about these signs, how reliable are some of these indicators when you're thinking versus just the variability in development?
It's a great question. So, you know, we always hear that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And we talk about the same thing, our team, for babies. We have we'll have a baby who has amazing eye contact, and then might go on to get a diagnosis of autism. We see things, markers show up later on with joint attention and maybe, you know, some repetitive behavior, things like that. So it's really, you know, some things that babies do that would be more indicative of getting a diagnosis, like eye contact. But then there's babies that might not have had great eye contact early on. We show, you know, the parents, of course, how to get more eye contact with their baby, and then they go on not to get a diagnosis. So did we, you know, intervene? And then, you know, mom really learns how to follow their baby's cues and learns what the baby loves in terms of, well, the baby loves when you sing. So now the baby's looking at you more so. So mom sings more, and, you know, we shape that. Mm-hmm. And is it that, and had we not been there, maybe eye contact wouldn't have developed in the same way, or a month later would eye contact have developed? So we don't really know, you know, if it's us or if it is that typical variability, like you mentioned, because we don't have a control group. So if we see something, we do treat. So if we see, you know, anything we would expect the baby to be doing, we show parents how to work on that.
Yeah, it's like you'll never really, I mean, you're not going to not give best practice and advice in that moment, of course.
That's right.
Can you tell me a little bit more about the Early Markers of Autism Project and what really their goal is and how you got involved in this project?
Oh, sure. So Dr. Becky McDonald started this project about 7 years ago, and she's since retired, but she still consults to us, which has been wonderful. So the study itself focuses on understanding those early signs of autism by tracking both those high-risk infants, so the babies that have a sibling diagnosed with autism. And then we have a group of what we call low-risk infants, so babies that don't have a sibling with autism. And we closely monitor their development to look for these early signs. We see the babies every 2 weeks. And this gives us the opportunity to start intervention at a younger than typical age. So again, you know, if we're seeing no reciprocal cooing at 2 months, we will work on that. And also, it might allow for an earlier diagnosis if a baby still is showing markers at 12 months of age, for example. We created a tool called the Early Markers of Autism Assessment, and that's what we use when we go out every 2 weeks. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we start with the 1 month skills and then we add on the 2 month skills and so on. And we're hoping to validate this tool so we can make it available for pediatricians for early autism detection. Right now, I think 18 months is when the typical screening for autism starts in the pediatrician's office. And our average babies are diagnosed much earlier than 18 months. So we want to be in there, especially with this vulnerable population, screening, you know, every month or more often if that was a possibility, so that we can treat or get these babies treatment earlier on. We have so far about 105 high-risk babies that have been in the program and about 62 low-risk babies. And we probably will be going for about 2 more years. I would continue to do it forever if that was possible, because it's just been so fun and rewarding. But again, what we'd like to see happen is for this assessment we're using to be used widespread. So pediatrician's office, early intervention, you know, some of those clinics that see siblings, and just helping to detect earlier on.
That's such valuable work. I mean, you think about that 18-month first assessment, and, you know, initially that seems like, oh, yeah, that's really young. But, I mean, when you're seeing babies at 1 month, the difference between 1 month and 18 months, I mean, there's so much time in between there and so much potentially lost opportunity.
It's so true. So this study started from Becky or Dr. McDonald's study that she did in 2014. And what she found was that she looked at, you know, three groups and looked at them, you know, baseline and then after EIBI. And the biggest factor in how they did, how they responded to treatment, was age. So she found the one-year-old group made the most progress. So that, you know, she went and thought to herself, well, what if we started even before 1 year of age? What, you know, what are their results going to look like then? So starting at 1 month versus, like you said, if you're not even getting screened till 18 months, and then we know there's wait lists for a diagnosis and then there's wait lists for treatment. So these kids aren't getting, you know, the services that could be really beneficial until later on.
Yeah, I mean, and parents are in the pediatrician offices anyways at those ages earlier than 18 months. So it seems like a natural place to embed that and integrate this process.
Right. Yeah, we're hoping it to make it a nice, you know, a quick screening so that, you know, they'll know what, whether it be the nurses or, you know, the pediatrician, know what to look for and then refer based on that screening.
I'm sure you hear this a lot when talking to parents and other caregivers, but what are some of the misconceptions that are common about early signs of autism in infancy?
So there are a lot, I'm sure you're aware, of videos online. You know, videos showing this is what my child looked like at, you know, for example, 6 months old, 12 months old. And I think parents do a lot of comparing to those videos and then, you know, make decisions based on that. But like we talked about earlier, each baby is so different. We see babies that have repetitive behavior, so some, you know, hand flapping and things like that. But then we see babies that end up with a diagnosis that have no repetitive behavior. So parents sometimes can hold on to this. Well, I read that, you know, my baby would definitely have repetitive behavior if they were going to have autism. So I'm not going to go forward with an eval because, you know, they don't do that, for example. Or eye contact. You know, eye contact isn't a concern with my baby. He makes great eye contact, you know, but they are having these other concerns. So they think that, you know, if the baby is making eye contact, then it's definitely not autism. So I think in general, it's sort of the misconception is that babies have to have these, you know, check these particular boxes, when it's really not that. We know autism can look so different in terms of, you know, social engagement and communication and repetitive behavior. So, you know, my advice is always go forward with an eval, see someone, you know, who knows and can help you if you have any concerns, rather than waiting and, you know, wait to see what happens with development.
Yeah, the spectrum makes it so complex for diagnosis because, like you said, yeah, I've definitely seen those videos and on either side, like this is what typical development looks like. And this is what my child who was later diagnosed looked like at 6 months, 12 months. And, you know, I think when you have a doubt in your mind about anything, you're kind of searching for things to validate or, you know, not validate that doubt.
You're right.
So when you're searching YouTube, you're going to fall into those examples no matter what.
You're right. And that's exactly what we see.
So you talked a little bit about like the example of, you know, the mom, you know, singing to the baby and that kind of encouraging eye contact. So I love hearing about those kind of like almost simple sounding strategies that can make such a big difference. But, you know, obviously if parents aren't knowledgeable about that, they're not going to know to do this strategy more often to encourage some of these behaviors. How do you introduce parents to that, this concept of, you know, naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions and how to use these in these everyday routines? It's not like a let's sit down for therapy time, that we can just do this throughout the whole day.
Yeah, exactly. That's the first thing we say to parents, right? This shouldn't really be extra work. This should be done, you know, when you're spending time with your baby during those everyday routines, like feeding, diapering. Those things are happening multiple times a day, right? So let's use that and not make it any more stressful. You know, parents have enough stress. And so we show them, you know, like you said, it is fairly simple when you look at it. So during diapering, for example, perfect time that you're about 10, 12 inches away from your baby. You know, you have to be there, they have to be there. So let's work on that reciprocal cooing. So, you know, if the baby makes a noise, make that noise back. If the baby isn't making noise, you play around with some of those noises, play around with some of those faces until you get something. And, you know, we work on it very naturally. And then the reinforcement, you know, is the baby making a sound, then you make that sound back and smile, and the baby likes that. So then it becomes this back and forth interaction, sort of fostering that connection between the parent and baby too. So, you know, you end up working on not only the reciprocal cooing, but then there's smiling happening, and then there's eye contact happening, you know, and laughing. And from cooing, by 7 months, now we're moving on to you're modeling some consonants and, you know, mama and da-da, and the baby's imitating that. And that's reinforcing in itself because now the baby said mama. And, you know, so everything sort of builds on the skill, the previous skill. And it's fun for both the parent and the child, especially, you know, when it happens fairly quickly.
I love the example of the diaper change because you're right. You both have to be there. You're right there, like, you know, 12 inches away. You can't be on your phone when you're changing a diaper or anything like that. So it's really kind of a built-in opportunity. What are some other good times of day that you suggest kind of easily embedding this in?
Feeding's good for eye contact. You know, with feeding, of course, we wouldn't work on the cooing because the baby's mouth is busy. But you're naturally about 6 to 8 inches from the baby. So it's while the baby's, you know, not distracted, but enjoying themselves having a bottle, or if, you know, breastfeeding, you can sing or talk, you know, see what your baby likes. If when you sing, they're looking at you and they're locked in, well, you might want to continue doing that, right? Because that's what the baby likes. That's what gets them to want to look at you. If they don't like your singing, but maybe they like when you talked softly and you notice that, then you want to do more of that. So it's all sort of, you know, about picking up on those babies' cues and shaping, right? So doing more of that to get, you know, more eye contact. So your baby enjoys when you talk, so you talk more, or, you know, whatever it is that you might do, like silly faces or silly sounds.
you know, you mentioned earlier, not only the reinforcer for the baby, but the it's reinforcing for the parent too. What is your advice when parents are not finding a lot of reinforcement in some of these interactions? Because at first it might take some time or some, you know, a little bit of repetition to get kind of that engagement, and maybe parents are getting frustrated.
Yeah. So when I first started on the project, my colleague, Sally Dupere, showed me how to really pick up on all of the moments, and, you know, point out what the baby's doing that's great. And there is always something that the baby is doing that's great. So, you know, a parent might be, you can tell, anxious or stressed that their baby isn't as chatty as they would like. You know, they said, you know, they don't hear a lot of cooing or sounds. But what we're seeing is every time the parent talks, they're, you know, quickly looking over and finding their voice and smiling when they see them. So we point out all of the amazing things they're doing so that they can work on those things, not work on, but, you know, notice those mm-hmm. things even more. So they're getting all of these great, you know, connection moments. And maybe the baby isn't cooing, so that is still stressful. But by pointing out all of the great things, it seems to lessen the anxiety about the thing the baby might not be doing as much of as they'd like.
Oh, I love that. Because, yeah, there's probably some small thing, whether it's not small, but something else that the baby is doing that if you hone in on, then, you know, you can picture a parent being like, okay, well, this is I'm seeing something good and something positive, and you just want to kind of continue those interactions and not have it be like aversive where we're not making any progress, so I'm going to stop doing this.
Right.
So, you know, I'm sure a lot of parents ask you this, but, and you kind of mentioned this earlier, but, and I've talked to parents that have had this question, you know, when I see some of these indicators or I notice that my baby's not doing what my friend's baby who's the same age is doing, should I wait and see, or should I, you know, seek out this like early support? I think there is a little bit of, you know, I don't know the right phrase for it, like negative energy or whatever that is around this, like, oh, maybe I'm being too paranoid. Maybe I'm being such a worrier around this early diagnosis or early assessment. But so maybe I should just wait. What advice do you give for parents in that situation?
It's a great question because our parents have a child with autism already. So they don't know if they're, like you said, being paranoid. They say, am I being paranoid because I already have a child with autism, you know, or are, you know, is this warranted? And our advice always is it never hurts to reach out to early intervention. Yeah. So, you know, it if at a certain age their baby isn't rolling over and it's really, you know, creating anxiety for them, we tell them, reach out. It never hurts to have mm-hmm. another set of eyes tell you it's okay. You know, there's a big range in rolling, so don't worry about it. But here are some things you can practice in the meantime. So we're lucky enough too that the parents in our study are typically really interested in early intervention, because when they sign up, they know that we're looking for those early markers and that we're going to treat them if they see them. So they're on board more so than maybe other parents would be. They're usually not the wait and see type.
Yeah, true. They're already in the study.
Right.
You know, I'm thinking about, you know, most of our listeners are special ed teachers, and especially thinking about those early childhood, preschool, kindergarten, first grade teachers that have kids with autism in their classrooms. And, you know, mom has another baby and is noticing some things, and the teacher is teacher/counselor. And, you know, a parent's like, hey, you know, actually, I'm not here to talk about my kindergartner. I'm here to talk about my baby, and I'm seeing all these things. And as a teacher, I often felt in an uncomfortable spot. Like, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a pediatrician, but I also want to give you good advice. So I love that phrase that you just gave, like, it never hurts to go reach out, because we're not giving any diagnostic information, anything like that, but we're still giving advice that is good.
Right.
And we're kind of addressing that like high risk situation with siblings. Yeah. This is so interesting to think about.
It's fun. I'm so lucky to be a part of this study. I always, you know, have worked with the little ones, and you know, mostly 2-year-olds, 18 months. And I thought, oh, I know everything there is to know about the little ones. And then I started working with the babies and realized, wow, there is so much to learn. And, you know, it's so much fun. And it's really interesting. And it's so fun to watch the parents also learn, you know, what babies can do and what they're capable of.
There's so many like communicative moments that happen with babies that I only really knew about from my background. And I always like love telling people that aren't in this field at all. Like, yeah, the cooing, like people don't even realize if you're not like, we think about that all the time, but if you're not under an education or speech pathology umbrella at all, you might not even realize the point of that cooing. So I was always interested when I was a parent going to pediatrician appointments, like what that looked like from that perspective, and was sometimes disappointed that pediatricians weren't pointing that out more. Cause I'm like, you don't know my background. Like these are things right. You should be pointing out to parents, because not everyone understands the importance of even things like that and that reciprocal language that happens so early.
You're right. Not only do parents not, you know that their babies should be cooing, they hear that they should be talking to their babies, which is also great. So they'll say, I knew I should talk back when my baby coos, but I didn't know I should imitate their coos, you know, and that's something I learned. And it's like, yeah, and then it's fun, you know, and they go back and forth and it's this great imitation.
I remember at a conference the first time I learned about like babies language and like that's really a thing, and like using baby talk and like imitating the sounds. I was like, oh my God, this all makes sense. But again, like, you know, you and I are in this world. So thinking about people that just don't have an education background, it's so important for doctors and those nurses that are seeing these babies at their 1 month and 3 month checkup to be sharing these things.
You're right. And that doesn't happen. You know, they have to go through so much. And, you know, I think the more we can educate, you know, the population, especially again with this vulnerable population of infant siblings, the better. And you know, it does help with social media. I see that parents are learning. You know, they'll tell me something they learned, but they're seeking it out too because they do already have a child with autism. But like you mentioned, if you don't, you're probably not seeking out that information.
Yeah. Their algorithm looks a little different.
Exactly. Yeah. It's true.
This has been so interesting, Erin. Where can people go to learn more from you and more about the Early Markers of Autism Project?
Yeah, so the project itself, you can look at the New England Center for Children's website, www.necc.org. And we did finish with recruitment for our high risk, but we hope to publish soon. So, you know, we'd love to talk again maybe when the study comes out, and we can talk to you all about the results we found and, you know, what markers are most indicative of a diagnosis with autism. So stay tuned for that. And I have a small private practice I always have with working at the New England Center as well. And I've expanded to include infants based on parent feedback. Like we've talked about, parents are anxious about their children's development. So I've had parents ask me, you know, I know what you do for the study, but I don't have a child with autism. Is there any way I could get a service like this, you know, for my baby? So that's something I've been doing. So we do online visits once a month, and we, with the baby and the mom and the dad or whatever caretaker would like to be there, we go through those developmental milestones and we look for them. And mom and dad can ask any questions that they have, you know, that they might not have thought to ask a pediatrician, or they're not there often enough, any concerns they might have. And then I'll give some homework, something fun to work on over the next month, and then we meet again. So that is at my website, www.talkingfirstwords.com. And yeah, that's about where you can reach me.
Great. I will share that in the show notes. And yeah, once the study is published, would love to have you back on to hear all about the results. It's really exciting.
Thank you. We're very excited for that.
Well, thank you so much, Erin. This has been so informative and so much valuable information. So thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening. Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VBMAP and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum. Everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.